So the session today, very interesting topic, board leadership in a complex world, optimising value from risk and opportunity. And we have presenting Sean McGinn and Andrew Brown, both of whom are well known, I'm sure. Just to say a little bit about Sean, he now, since August 2010, runs his own boutique personal consulting firm, McGinn Advisory and Actuarial. He's based in Melbourne and a primary focus on superannuation wealth management markets, including retirement incomes and life insurance. And he offers a personalised service to directors, senior executives and their teams. Prior to that, a long and distinguished career with Ernst & Young, his own consulting firm, and various forms of Eagle Life, as far as I can tell. So welcome, Sean. And also to introduce Andrew Brown. Andrew has been a director of Lead First since 2011. He partners with clients in building effective leadership cultures through developing leadership capacity at the individual, team and organisational level. And he supports clients to address their business strategies through developing effective leadership models, mindsets and practices. He's a member of the ACTRA's Institute Leadership Committee. Of course, we all know he writes a regular column on leadership in ACTRA's magazine. I'm not sure that everybody understands that it's the leadership column in ACTRA's magazine, so I will point that out for Jenny Lyon's benefit, so she'll be very happy with me for saying that. Previously, Andrew had responsibilities included being Chief Financial Officer for the Philippines AXA Life, Chief Actuary for AXA Life Singapore, and Head of Learning and Leadership Development for AXA Australia. So a couple of really fascinating speakers on that convergence of the actuarial world and leadership, and I'm really looking forward to hearing you both speak. Thank you.
Thank you, Anthony. What we're really looking forward to, Andrew and I, is the fascinating discussion at the end of our speaking. So we're on a bit of a tight schedule. We're open to being moved along. Now, firstly, you've had a bit of an introduction this morning to some of the topics we'll be talking about this afternoon. There was quite a bit on enterprise risk management and leadership and even risk culture sneaked in. So we thought our thunder might have been taken. But then we thought, oh, maybe you're just being warmed up and now you're an informed audience. So let's see how it goes. Now, the idea for this paper really came from an overlap of several interests and passions that I have. My first is a deeply held belief that as actuaries we're capable of using our talents much more widely than in the narrow financial services. And the other was around leadership and risk management, enterprise risk management. Leadership, when I was thinking of writing this, I thought, well, who's an expert on leadership that might understand me? And that probably means an actuary. So I immediately thought of Andrew Brown and invited him along. And we've really enjoyed the journey in putting this together from quite disparate sets of experiences that we've had, but with some overlap. So thank you, Andrew. The other area around enterprise risk management, I started to get very interested in at Ascot Consulting many years ago. And since in the last few years, I've actually, as some of you may know from, I think, the Financial Services Forum last year, I've been a director on the board of my daughter's secondary college for the last 5 years, and we went on a risk management journey together, the board and I and the school. And it was an incredible learning experience, but also very opening in terms of my mind of what as actuaries we can do. So basically, I'm continuing that journey and sharing with you the learnings. Okay, put those together, and hey presto, we've got this paper. So we're looking at board leadership, we're looking at risk management, and we're looking at the risk culture within that. We've got a couple of objectives. We want to explore the role of the board and how that flows through to risk management, but also at the very end, we're going to have a look at what it means for actuaries. The role of the board. Well, let's start with the basics, roles and responsibilities. Now, risk culture and risk and leadership have several definitions. So we'll go through what we mean by that. There's an amazing overlap with this morning around the things we do around here, but then we go a bit deeper further on. What's interesting in this set of roles is that five and six are perhaps a little bit unusual. I did the director's course, the Australian Institute of Company Directors course last year, and I was fascinated to see 5 and 6 here, risk appetite and risk culture as being key elements of what they were teaching their people going through. And that's relatively new in the last few years. So it does play right into our hands as far as our backgrounds, our training and our skills. So there is an awareness of these right across boards and governance in terms of what should be done. The reality at the grassroots level, particularly in smaller entities, including perhaps many non-for-profits, is that there isn't the same practice or experience in assessing risk, in integrating risk in everything that people do along the way. Okay. What do we mean by enterprise risk management? For the board to set the organization's risk appetite, each director needs to understand what risk is and needs to understand how it might be managed across the whole enterprise, that key integration. Now, the ASX Corporate Governance Rules defines risk management as the culture, processes, and structures that are directed towards taking advantage of potential opportunities while managing potential adverse effects. So it's a two-way thing. It's opportunities as well as adverse effects. If we look at enterprise risk management, then it's basically looking at all the potential risks and opportunities across the full organization. And it's integrating that comprehensively throughout. And that means within strategy, within decision making, as well as the more normal compliance and health and safety and such elements. James Lamb was the person who first coined the term chief risk officer. And he stated that risk management is firstly about balancing risk and reward, and that the challenge for leaders is to take intelligent risks. It is more important to ensure that the right people are in place to begin with than having the right processes, and that those people are motivated by the right culture and incentives. So it's right at the heart of enterprise risk management, and it's right at the heart of leadership. Now, the reality is that the downside of risk is in most people's bloodstreams. It's in CEOs' bloodstreams. The opportunity side tends to get neglected, particularly in times of stress. And for anyone who's a CEO, and for lots of us that are not CEOs, but reporting to CEOs, or even on boards, looking down to CEOs to do the work that we've hired them to do, then the time constraints are enormous. It's very hard to make the time to think about the upsides, about the opportunities. And a lot of that comes down to the culture that's in the organization. So I'll pass over to Andrew now to take us through culture.
I'll just touch on one of the points Sean made before around CEOs. I was speaking to a fellow recently who'd interviewed over 50 CEOs around their perspectives on risk and their perspectives on resilience. And he said, and this is a guy who's done a lot of work actually with the Institute of Actuaries from a company called Incept Labs to understand actuaries' attitude towards risk, which we'll show you later. And he said, of the 50 CEOs that they had interviews with, 45 of them, when they talked about risk, talked about it as mitigation. Only 5 of them actually talked about risk as being opportunity. So culturally, in organisations, even the most senior people are often still seeing risk as the stuff that we want to stop doing rather than the opportunities that we want to take. And that does come down to culture. Now, I was going to ask you guys what you thought of culture, but I think today people said what culture means is the stuff that happens about here. The work that Sean and I have done, or the research we did, we came across a guy called Ed Shine. Ed Shine's probably one of the global leaders around what does culture mean. And he puts it down to 3 things. And I just want to take you through these because I think they're important in setting the context for boards. The first thing that Ed said is culture is about the artifacts in the organisation. Do you know when you first walk into the organisation and you look at the front desk, what's a person like on the front desk? Is it an open office? Do they have pictures of the history of the organisation? What's the communication like when you walk in there? Can you actually feel how people communicate? Are they talking together? Does it have a sterile atmosphere? For him, there's the artefacts, the things that you can observe and see. So when we're reflecting here from a board perspective, it'll be, what do the board meetings look like? How official or formal are the board meetings that they're in? How does the board interact with people who come and see them? If you're doing a presentation to the board, I know I've done presentations to the board when I felt it was a little bit like firing questions at me. Yeah? Other times it can be much more like a dialogue. So those types of things very much gets into the sense of what is the culture of the organisation. But beyond the artefacts, which is the first part of culture, is the espoused values of the organisation. And I'm sure most of you have seen these on the walls of the organisation. Mm-hmm. Values. Just, can anyone just call out, what are some of the values of your organisation? Just a bit of a scatter.
Integrity.
Integrity, great. What else?
Accountability.
Yep. Sorry?
Teamwork.
Okay. So integrity, accountability and teamwork. I guarantee you could look up 95% of organisations will have integrity, accountability and teamwork. Right? That is the espoused values of the organisation. That's the stuff on the walls that people put up. That's not where culture is enacted though. Culture is often enacted in the space between what we say we're going to do and what we really do. And this is what Shine calls the tacit assumptions in an organisation. Yeah? And when you have a say-do gap, and every organisation to a smaller or larger degree will have some kind of say-do gap between what they say they do and what they really do, what do people infer about what's really important in the organisation? More often than not, they infer what's important by people's actions. There's an expression from Ralph Waldo Emerson which goes along the lines of, what you do speaks so loudly that I cannot hear what you say. Yeah? What you do speaks so loudly, I cannot hear what you say. That's what culture is about. When there's that gap between what we say we do and what we really do, that informs people about the culture. So taking that back from a context of the board, it's the implicit messages the board sends about what's important. It's the hiring decisions they make. It's what they agree to as much as what they don't agree to. It's what is on the board agenda as much as what's not on the board agenda. They're all the things that will frame and shape the culture of the organisation. Sean, did you have any other comments on culture before we move on?
No.
Okay, great. So looking at how cultures emerge or evolve over time, there's when I started working in 1988, March the 7th, 1988, back in the old National Mutual at 447 Collins Street, culture wasn't something that was talked about. It was probably only really came into the work that I was doing maybe in the late 90s or early 2000s when people really started to see it as a way of making change in an organisation or shaping an organisation. And that, if you like, is intuitive culture. Now, when we look at risk culture, risk, like any other type of culture, will have an evolution over time. This morning, Josh Corrigan talked about ERM 3.0, was it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that's really moving very much towards the right-hand side around mature. So just to give you a sense of how organisations may evolve and how risk has been evolving in the last 20 years, in the first column, when there is the absence of a risk culture, the individual people, individual mindset's going to be unaware. We're not even aware of the risks that we're taking, right? We don't even see risk as part of what we do in the drink water. Group mindset is there might be low trust because when a risk does happen, then everyone scatters everywhere and there's a question about why did the risk occur. It might even be more of a blame culture rather than a working together. Behaviours might appear reckless because people aren't even aware of the risks that they're taking. Systems, there's probably not going to be many systems about risk, and there's either going to be a very small risk function or it's going to be called something like compliance and it's going to be policing. Yeah? As you shift and the culture matures and says a whole heap of things happen there that we don't want to happen, there's a whole heap of consequences, you start shifting to reacting to that. And so you get much more around the risk-averse and compliance side of a culture. As that evolves, the challenge then is, okay, that's great, we're now mitigating and taking away the risks that we don't want to do and we're tracking those, but how do we start actually improving performance? How do we start looking at risk as also being an opportunity in the organisation? So at this point, it becomes much more risk aware, there becomes much more commitment to around risk, behaviours start focusing on efficiency and performance, and the risk function is actually looking at not just the compliance side, but how you get continuous improvement into the organisation. As you shift towards a proactive culture, it becomes much more integrated. It's in the drink water of the organisation. And it's almost like if I was imagining how this would play out, to me, each person in the organisation, as you progressively go towards the right, the role of risk gets much more distributed through the organisation. It becomes much more about individuals' responsibilities. In the keynote this morning, one of the questions was asked, how do you get people to see risk management as not being an obstacle to their day-to-day work, and they're going to be really frustrated by it as being something else which is imposed on them? As you're starting to shift towards that right and it's integrated, people start actually seeing risk as part of their role. The conversations start occurring in the teams. It's owned much more at the work group. It might still be driven by the manager at this stage, but the behaviours are now shifting from efficiency to effectiveness, much more focused around materiality of risk. Yeah? Systems are much more now looking at what's the feedback we're getting, what is actually happening, how do we keep managing this on a regular basis, and the risk function starts to shift towards a partnering arrangement. Now, anyone who works in an auditing function, I think the smiles start coming out as the partnering starts to come through, because the auditing function and the compliance function are not seen as the police anymore in the organisation. The meaning starts to shift towards they're actually helping us and supporting the evolution of the business. Does that resonate with people? Can you sort of see where different sides might sit, different organisations you've worked in at different stages? For the mature risk culture, I think that's very aspirational. The way that Sean and I built this model, if you like, is looking at models that have been done in a lot of depth in safety cultures around safety, but also to me has a lot of overlays when you look at any kind of cultural journey that people go on. If you talked about a culture of leadership, to me one of the key themes there is distributed leadership. Here there's that distributed risk management. So that right column, it's now risk equals opportunity. Yeah? Risk appetite is not just what risks we don't want to take, but it's how we're going to actually take the risks that are going to drive this business forward. Behaviours become much more strategic, so the emphasis is around growth, and the risk function is around supporting or empowering the business. Again, aspirational, but that's the opportunity. So, now, how then does this feed back into the board and how they shape a culture? Ed Schein quote, if you set out to change the culture, you end up in fog. Thank you, Ed, that's very helpful, but then how do you actually shape culture? If you set out to change behaviours, then you'll change culture. He, in his research, came across 10 key themes which shape culture. I'm only going to speak to the first four today, which are what a leader attends to, measures, rewards and controls is the number one factor that will shape the culture. Symbolically, what the board attends to, measures, rewards and controls will send to the organisation the message about what is important and what the organisation stands for. How leaders react to critical incidents. Yeah? So when something happens, when the proverbial S hits the fan, how does a leader respond? Do they blame? Do they put the wagons in the circle? Do they start trying to get different insights and different people to work together on how they're going to move it forward? Gives you a big sense of the culture. Leader role modelling. What's the expectation? What does the board want to see in the organisation? That's about the role modelling. How do they set that up? Critical part. And the fourth one is criteria for recruitment, promotion and retirement. So one of the key themes which we'll touch on in terms of the interviews that we did with directors of boards was the importance of the CEO. Right? Fundamentally, one of the key things that will drive that culture and one of the ways that the board have an insight into the organisation is the recruitment of the CEO. So very quickly talking through board leadership, three key themes there. If the board is to set an example around leadership, it's going to be how they lead by example, how they lead through people, and how they lead the strategy. Just a couple of thoughts. We can explore this in Q&A a little bit more in depth. But around the leading by example, that will be how the board connects with each other. It will be how, when external people come into the board from the organisation, how the board treats them, deals with them, works through them, that gives the expectation of what they're looking for in the culture. Leading people won't just be about hiring, it'll be about the respect, it'll be about potentially challenging each other as board members. It'll be about diversity, how you get diversity of thoughts and actually really leverage that rather than, yeah, that's very nice, Harry, but I never agree with you, so I'll go and do what I'm doing anyway. Now, it's that piece of how you really leverage each other's differences. And then leading strategy, for me, there's lots of things we could say there, but the one fundamental piece around a risk culture is that risk is embedded in every strategic conversation that the board have. So when the board are talking about strategy, they're talking about the risks that are going to drive the strategy as well as the risks that they want to mitigate. So over to you, Sean.
What I'm going to talk about now is just take you through some of the responses from the directors. So we interviewed 9 directors in total. 6 of them were actuaries and 3 of them were not. We spent about a half an hour with each, but we covered quite a bit of ground. So there's a number of different responses. You can see them there on the slide. I won't repeat all the details. But just to expand on perhaps some of them, things like scenario planning is great to enable you to actually go through an experience. And it's that experiential learning in effect that actually helps you deal with risk the next time it comes around. It's important to get an outside perspective. So have an expert that you trust. If you're a board member or a chair, have someone else that can come and tell you like it is from a totally different perspective. On governance and operational risk management, focus on what should be on the agenda rather than what is on it. So it's that independent thinking that you need to bring all the time. The evolving nature of leadership, what Andrew was referring to there with regard to the CEO and the chair, that relationship is absolutely critical all the way through. But there must be trust. Trust is fundamental both between the members of the board or within the board itself, between the chair and the CEO, and also down to the senior management. That's got to be there at the heart of a mature culture, a mature risk culture too, in terms of being able to recognise what's not quite right, what might go wrong, and be able to respond to that. One interesting part was business partners must be supportive if you're going to get through a really big shake-up. You know, if the GFC hits you well, if your distribution force turns off your products, then you know you're in big trouble. So it's having those long-term life relationships with your suppliers, with your distributors, that really comes to bear. And that's not going to be something you can put in place when a GFC hits. It's got to be there for a long time before. Integrating risk leadership into strategic leadership. Keep out of the weeds that rather than focusing on focus the agenda on strategic opportunities. You know, keep that focus. Keep out of the weeds is what Andrew and I term that. And risk needs to be part of every conversation, and it should inform every decision, which is coming back again to what Andrew said. So these were all direct comments back from the people that we interviewed. At the end of the day, risk is what makes you the money. Having a real sense of risk appetite and the opportunities that brings and that emerge from risk is really what you want to embed within the organization's strategy. So it's really living, breathing risk. And actuaries have a lot to offer there in terms of our skills and our innate understanding of the possibilities of risk, but also knowing our limitations. That's important. Mm. Okay, some case studies. The good. We actually found some good. It was mentioned this morning at the plenary session that they're a bit hard to come by because they don't scream out at you. I'll just focus on 2 of these examples. The first is the GFC for some US businesses. Now, every business didn't go bust during the GFC, either in Australia or overseas. Some did, and we know about those. But the Ivy Business School ran a convention in 2010, and they had about 300 C-suite people there to basically discuss what they did that worked and what they did that didn't work during the GFC. And what they found was that good leadership certainly did make a difference, especially with regard to risk management. The people that understood the potential impact and wider implications of those problems took immediate steps to circumvent them. And I'm quoting these here from those studies. They also said essentially these organizations had cultures attuned to potential risks with the ability to manage dynamics effectively. So the evidence is there that it does work. There is a very strong influence from a positive risk culture, and it is the leader's responsibility to manage risk effectively. So three simple things that should be done well, and this is direct from the feedback from these guys. One, the best leaders ask the right questions. Secondly, they consult with a mix of people with different perspectives, different backgrounds, and different ranges of knowledge. And the most effective leaders during the GFC were people who had integrity, courage, and compassion. They were careful, prudent, and aware of their limitations. That's a culture. That's a really mature risk culture, and they're the people who did best. A local example is APRA. I was wondering, would Ian comment on this morning? Is Ian in the building? No, he's not in the building. One of the things that's impressed Andrew and I over the years is how APRA has changed from a very poor culture in terms of addressing risk back when HIH was there, and you know they were newly formed and there's lots of mitigating circumstances. But APRA as an organisation, did not do very well around that time, but they learnt their lessons, and over the past 10 years have taken that to heart and have actually turned around internally with good leadership around appropriate risk cultures and also in the in getting across their message to the organisations that they supervise. Charles Littrell said in 2011, there is no good prudential regulation without good supervision. There is no good supervision without a culture of effective intervention. We've seen the good, lots of bad and ugly too. I won't dwell over these because we are running short of time. We all know the stories of the terrible trading losses, be it derivatives or be it NAB's foreign exchange. And you look at what the various inquiries said about those disasters, and they're all incredibly strongly linked to culture. I love this bit from the Royal Commission, so I'll have to read this bit. Neville Owen said, the problematic aspects of the corporate culture of HIH, which led directly to the poor decision-making, can be summarised succinctly. There was blind faith in a leadership that was ill-equipped for the task. There was insufficient ability and independence of mind in and associated with the organisation to see what had to be done and what had to be stopped or avoided. Risks were not properly identified and managed. Unpleasant information was hidden, filtered, or sanitised, and there was a lack of sceptical questioning and analysis when and where it mattered. I don't need to say any more, really. We could stop now. Key messages there for all of us. I'll hand you back to Andrew now, and he'll talk about some of the obstacles to actually attaining that mature risk culture.
Sean is a big Dilbert fan, so I really couldn't go past without finding a place to put a Dilbert quote into the paper. So Scott Adams once said, "Most success springs from an obstacle or failure. I became a cartoonist largely because I failed in my goal of becoming a successful executive." So thank goodness that he did. So we're going to take through what are some of the obstacles which the board directors that we spoke to identified in terms of building towards a mature risk culture. And I think it's important just to highlight these because on any kind of journey there will be obstacles. So the first four, death by regulation, drinking the Kool-Aid, rubber bands and sterility. Death by regulation came up in a sense that some of the board directors felt that the compliance regime that they were under was so strong that they felt it actually stopped them from effectively managing the risks that they need to and focusing on the strategy. And so it became a challenge for the board on how they put things in place to make sure that they could focus on the strategic aspects rather than just the operational. Drinking the Kool-Aid is an expression we stole from Barry Rafe, so thank you, Barry. The drinking the Kool-Aid is about groupthink. When one person in the room thinks something, what does everyone else do? Do they actually follow on? And the challenge at the board level is getting that diversity of thinking and making sure that everyone has a view so that you get a well-informed and wise view. In terms of rubber bands, the rubber bands piece is about this, that often when people's behaviours revert is when they're under the most stress or duress. So you can do a lot of work and you can move forward and everything can look great, but when the S hits a proverbial fan, how do people respond to that? Right? And so the challenge then is how do you actually prepare? What's the groundwork that you need to do prior to an event occurring so that people can maintain presence in the difficult circumstances? And the last one, sterility, I think, Sean, you touched on in terms of HIH when you read out that quote. And it's often about a number of the directors expressed a concern that sometimes they felt that there might be times when the CEO puts people in front of the board that the CEO may want to make sure that he's in control of the message. Would that surprise anyone in the room? No. Right? And so the concern here was the board wanted to find ways that they could make sure that the information they were getting wasn't so sterile and so sanitised that it actually lost the concerns or lost the juice in terms of what they could get out of it. Next four obstacles: the great dictator, starving child, modelomania, and night blindness. The great dictator was very much about the very strong CEO. So often the board will put in place a CEO who's got a lot of strength, who's got a lot of vision and wants to take the organisation in a certain place. And it's really well intended for the organisation to put that person in place. But sometimes there also needs to be the balance of how do you make sure that person's accountable and it comes back to being in the best interest of the organisation. Starving child, in a number of the not-for-profits we spoke about, they identified one of their key challenges was resources. How much resource does the organisation actually put into risk management? If you're going to take it seriously, where's the investment? Modelomania. Modelomania was some directors who are unfamiliar with models can sometimes confuse the model for reality. Yeah? The model is not reality, it's just an approximation to reality. How do you make sure that people understand the real practical considerations rather than take the model as gospel? And we're going to explore that a bit more in opportunities for actuaries. The last one was night blindness. And night blindness was about the things that we can't see in the night, so the things that we're actually not conscious or aware of. And that's the black swans, which a number of people have already spoken about today. So how will the boards get that into their consciousness? They were the obstacles. When Sean and I went through and put together the case studies, the conversations we had with the directors, the book research that we did, we reached these conclusions, which we would love to have a chat with everyone about in a couple of minutes. And that is, the first one is that risk needs to be integral in every decision. Yeah? Not just the minimising of risk, but the strategy as well. It needs to be part in the drink water of the board and drink water of the conversation. The board sets the tone for the meeting. You need to invest in a mature leadership culture, and you need to have diversity in the top team. They're really the key themes there. Let's move to what we would suggest as recommendations. We would suggest that one of the things that if the board's going to continually improve governance, improve resilience, and achieve objectives via actions, which we sort of see as the three key pieces that we're trying to bring together here, they might need an external perspective. Yeah? Culture is something that's still emerging. How can they get that external perspective, whatever that might look like, whether it's coaching the board at senior management, whether it's having diverse members of the board, being open to the different dynamics. We've got in quotes here for real scenario planning. And the for real means looking genuinely at the real risks that are emerging rather than a sanitised view of risks. Yeah? So we know interest rates have varied significantly in the past. Does that always come through in the scenario plans in the future? Promote that there's a challenging culture and have an ongoing annual review of risk. So there are some of the key recommendations that we came up with. So with that in mind, Sean, how does that relate to us as actuaries?
Because most of you are actuaries,
this will be very fast so that we have some time for discussion. Okay, opportunities for actuaries. INSEP Labs have done some very interesting research on what are the main attributes of a number of professions in terms of interacting with other people and how they go about doing analysis. And the key one in this is, if you look over on the right-hand side, actuaries, and down on the left-hand side, you'll see there's the triangle comes over to what's hyper-rational. You won't be able to read that unless you've got hypersight from anywhere near the back. Hyper-rational versus, so the auditors, the second from the right, are absolute, so everything has to be exactly right. In contrast, the operational managers are responsive, and the emergency managers at figure two, you know, they're automatic, immediate response. So they're very different responses. The key message from that research is that as actuaries, we need to be incredibly careful not to be over-rational. And we need to be also very careful that other people around a board table don't dismiss us for being far too hyper-rational, far too backward-looking in terms of wanting data to make sense out of things. There we go. Actuaries are more likely to be risk-averse. They need more data, can't cope with uncertainty. And that's something, if you're on a board or if you're in senior management, obviously you need to deal with uncertainty all the time. The trick is you need to convert that uncertainty into a clear message that the organization can go forward on. And that's not easy for some of us. Strength of actuaries in enterprise risk management and on boards, the director's views were that every member has an expertise that's different from the others. And in the actuary's case, being able to look forward is very useful relative to some of the other people. And that may appear simple, but that's quite an attribute. I'll just let you soak those up. Most of them are fairly obvious, but very important. Development opportunities for actuaries on boards. We have to be very clear about navigating through the uncertainties, and that is about giving a message. So distilling the information, distilling the uncertainties, but then being clear about the sort of actions that are required to be taken. So it's quite practical. Speak your mind. Have the courage that we talked about earlier. Have the discussion. It doesn't have to be an aggressive type discussion or that you're right and everybody else is wrong, because that's not going to be the case. It's about stating your view, giving your reasons, and then having the dialogue around that. And let's not forget about the human side of things. We talked about safety culture earlier around risk and culture. Humanity is more important than financials. Okay, I think I'll leave it at that, because we're just there for a few minutes. Thank you. You're going to throw me off.
So thanks, Sean. Andrew, that was a fascinating topic and discussion. We've got just under 10 minutes for questions. There are some rules which I'm expected to enforce, which is, because this is a recorded session, can you make sure you come to the microphone, say who you are, where you're from, speak, and make sure the question is articulated clearly. And no grandstanding with 5-minute presentations on your own points of view. They're questions, not statements. So who's going first? Yes, Elaine.
Elaine Collins. I've been on the board of Zurich Insurance as the next executive director for 6 months now, and I have to say that some of your observations Sean, were really interesting. The one particular one I really, really noticed in the last 6 months is any opportunity that comes to the board is related straight back to the risk appetite statement and what risks could arise with that opportunity. And it's so ingrained that I really think boards have come a very long way in the last 10 years. My question, actually, I loved your title too of balancing risk and opportunity, because so many people talk about balancing risk and strategy. And to me, strategy has to encompass opportunities and risks. That's really the summary of everything. The two things I think that are in opposite are risks and opportunities. But your one comment was that management and directors often can only see the downside of risks and not the upside, and it's hard to sometimes get them to see both sides. And I wondered if insurers might be better at that, because insurers, actually, their business is taking on other people's risks. So I wondered if you noted that perhaps the directors and management of insurers were better at noting the opportunities associated with risks.
I think they are, yes. What we found was that the directors that we interviewed, and there was a fairly large concentration around financial services and insurance within that, particularly with six actuaries, those interviews were much more balanced with regard to risk and opportunity, as opposed to the particular research that INSEP Labs did, which Andrew was speaking to, where they interviewed those 50 chief executives and 45 of them, you know, said risk and didn't think of opportunity. And I think that's a feature of the degree of, well, one being in financial services, where it's heavily regulated and there's a lot of expectations around risk, and you have more risk professionals in most of those places, compared to outside of financial services. But also the size of the companies involved makes a big difference.
Okay, next. Yes.
Firstly, guys, well done. Great presentation. Great maturity model, Andrew, and the hints. And I think that you really emphasised the role of the board really well. So congratulations on that. Quick question about the hyper-logical actuary and the risks that come with that. I see that often, and very often I see actuaries not being effective in a risk management context, because they, from their perspective, think they're looking at the blindingly obvious, and then when other executives who think differently don't seem to fall to the same logical conclusions, that seems to create frustration and angst, and ultimately winds up leading to a much less effective, engaging conversation. So I guess, does that resonate with you guys? And what hints and tips would you give actuaries to help overcome some of those traps that we often fall into?
Okay. Sure. Thanks, Mike. There's two slides we skipped at the end which partly answered or addressed our thoughts around that. And our observation, Sean and I went through and looked at our own careers, the careers of people we'd worked with from an actuarial perspective, and some of the feedback from the board. The board of directors did not see the actuaries who were in front of the boards or the actuaries who were on boards as being hyper-rational. Right? And that was actually a really important finding for us. So at one level, you've got INSEP Labs who are taking a broad cross-section of the population, saying there's this tendency towards hyper-rationality, but at the board level, there's not. When we discussed that with INSEP Labs and looked at our own experiences, we came to the conclusion that, again, a maturity model is like there's three phases that you step through. Phase number one is you learn about the profession that you're part of. You understand the tools, you understand the language. Phase number two is you become a practitioner in that field, and you bring that out into what you do. But often it's still within your own constraints and your own models. And there's a third phase, which we don't think all professionals go to, regardless of their careers, whether it's actuaries or lawyers. It's a step beyond being a professional within the own context of the profession to actually being able to be a much broader professional. And it's about being able to understand other people's perspectives and risks and hold your own perspectives more lightly. And we sort of, when we discussed that, we felt that, partly that will be because some people in their lives, in their careers, will have challenges where they actually have to step back from that. Some people will have a natural inclination to look for other views and things that haven't been part of their training. Other people will be very comfortable doing what they're doing because that's what's important for their immediacy of their role. So I haven't answered your question specifically in terms of what can you do, but the observations we have is that I think there's a whole variety of things that feed into that. Sean, did you have...
I think in terms of what you can do, key to all of this, as with most personal development, is being acutely aware of oneself and one's limitations. And related to that is get out more. Widen your experience. A great idea is to get onto a not-for-profit board. It's an incredibly good way of actually seeing how the rest of the world operates. And can operate extremely well.
I'm glad you said that, Sean. That's one of my things. Get out there more. I think we've just about run out of time, actually, because we've got 2 minutes to go, unless there's one really quick question. But otherwise...
Can I?
Yeah, sure.
Just one last point. You might have noticed on the second slide that, that there is a paper behind this, and we would encourage you to read that. And if you've got any comments, please... feel free to feed them back to us, because there's quite a bit of meat in there that we didn't get a chance to cover.
Okay, thanks, Sean. Thanks, Andrew. Would everyone please put their hands together to thank Sean and Andrew.